without repetition. Okay, and that's why it's very important that we make notes and make time to reflect. Because if you come here, you just listen, you don't make a note, you don't spend time reflecting, then nothing would remain. Whatever effort you put in, all the leaves that you have taken, all the money you spent to travel this far, well, it's going to be a good experience, but what will happen after this? You agree with that? So there is a need to make some time to make notes and also to make some time to reflect. And I'm going to share in this session of what is the science behind the meditation and how on the path of spirituality, if we want to take the benefit, one fundamental aspect that we should all remember is very good. Continuous practice. Because if you don't practice, it's as good as in a few weeks' time as if you never came here. It becomes just a distant memory. If you want to take the benefit and you want to help yourself, you have been hearing to Sister Shivani and to another wonderful class from Sister Radhika, very simple but very, very profound things. We listen and we like it, but if we don't reflect, it doesn't become a part of us. In Raj Yoga we have, and even in Sanskrit or Hindi, we have some very beautiful words. It's called as Swaroop. If it doesn't become a part of your being, then you won't be able to get the benefit out of it. So I would encourage, I know when you come here, we keep you busy. It's not the busy, busy kind of stuff. It is the easy, busy kind of stuff, hopefully. Yeah? So please make some time, take some notes, reflect, and then see how you're going to apply what you're learning here once you climb down the mountain. Up the mountain, everything is beautiful. All the trouble starts once you descend the mountain. So when I'm going to descend the mountain, when I'm up the mountain, when I'm on the peak, if I can think about the valley, if I can visualize, when I'm on the peak, if I can visualize the valley, and then plan for my stay in the valley, climbing the next peak becomes easy. But when I forget, and when I get into the valley, it's always important that I recall my experience on the peak. When I'm on the peak, visualize how you're going to handle the situations in the valley. And when I get to the valley, periodically recall your experience on the peak. When somebody is dead, what does their ECG show? Yeah? Flat line. But if somebody is alive, like us, if we take our ECG, there are peaks and valleys, and that's life. That's life. There was somebody once, a friend of Norman Vincent Peale asked him, the guy who wrote about the positive thinking and who started the revolution about positive thinking, his friend asked him, I am really frustrated. If you think positive thinking works and there are people in this world who are always happy, I want to meet them. So Norman said, okay, I'll show you. Come, let's go. He said, are you sure? I mean, can you show me somebody who's always happy? He said, fine, I can. So, and who never faces any troubles in life? He said, fine, I will. So he drove them for a few miles, few tens of miles, and then they move out of the city, and then he finally takes him, you know where? He takes him to a cemetery. And then he shows, and then he says, here are the people who have never faced any trouble. The people who never face any trouble are those who are yet to be born and those who are dead. If you're alive, if you're facing an issue, it means you're alive. So that was a very good lesson for his friend. So don't be scared of what you're going to see in the valley. Eventually, we have to get into the valley because that's where we spend most of our time. But periodically, do keep visiting the peak. And you don't have to wait for one full year to climb up the peak. Yes or no? You can do it even for a few minutes every day. That's all it takes. Good, so that was a little bit about the peaks and valleys. And if those of you are interested, that's the name of a very interesting book by Spencer Johnson, the guy who has written Who Moved My Cheese book. He has written this book also about peaks and valleys. So if you are interested, you might want to read through that. He beautifully compares, gives this beautiful analogy of life and the situations we face between with peaks and valleys. Peaks and Valleys, that's the name of the book. Peaks, P-E-A-K-S, and Valleys. Okay. All set? So now how's the Josh? How's the Josh? How's the Josh? Very good. So let's begin. First, I wanted to give you, which I could not do in the morning because of the interesting mismatch or dislike between Apple and Microsoft. So you have your tags, and then there is a virtue that's printed. Tomorrow, we are going to have a session from 4 o'clock onwards, and this is very important. At sharp 4, we are going to start the video, which is going to become the foundation for the next couple of hours facilitated reflection and conversation. So we encourage you to please be here sharp by 3:50 tomorrow afternoon. So it starts at 4, and from 4 to 4:30, we are going to watch a beautiful video called Celebrate What's Right with the World. And once we watch, we will all walk out of the hall to the respective venues where we are going to have this facilitated conversation and reflection. So make a note of your venue. If resilience it is, then your venue is Training Center 3. So please make a note of this and I'll tell you where they are. All these training centers you see here, they are in the building opposite. As soon as you come out of the Harmony Hall to your left, you see a ramp that goes up. And then there's a building to the right. To the left is Harmony Hall, where some of you are staying. And to the right is the training center. So you go inside, you will have the numbered rooms. So you go to your respective rooms there. Training Center 3 is basically hall number 3 in training center. That's what is labeled as Training Center 3. And then once you enter the training center, to the left, there is some open area. That is what we call this as training center open area. So those of you who got this virtue of freedom, all of you will go to this place. And simplicity, you're going to use, if you are climbing down the stairs, if you're climbing down, towards your left, you see an audiovisual counter. Yes? So beside that, there's a lot of open space between the meditation hall and the audiovisual counter. That is where you will gather all those who are written as simplicity. Is okay? And harmony will be here inside the Harmony Hall because the reflection and the session will happen here. And for the joy, it will be just outside in the lobby where you had the chai in the morning. So these are your venues, and I would encourage that those of you who are here, where whose venue is in the training center, today evening or tomorrow morning, just walk by so that you don't spend time trying to figure it out where your venue is. Okay? And I would encourage each one of you to participate. A lot of effort has gone into preparing that. We have got some really wonderful facilitators from all over India who are going to help us facilitate the conversation. Okay? Good. So that's what we will be discussing, how our thoughts impact our health and how our mind impacts the body. One fundamental thing that we need to remember based on the research that is being done in the last 5 decades is this. Human body is biologically endowed with all the necessary infrastructure to help us grow mentally and spiritually. Even if we don't want to, we grow physically. That's why I didn't put it there. Okay? So human body has all the necessary biological infrastructure, and we'll explore what does that mean in the next few minutes. For 200 years, Western medicine never believed that mind can impact body. Even to this day, we have even some doctors in the audience. As a part of the MBBS curriculum, you are not taught much about the impact of mind on the body. Research in the last 50 years has been showing irrefutable evidence of how our thoughts impact every aspect of our body, every aspect of our health. And today, we will learn about those, and we will also explore how we can harness the power of our thoughts in order to become both physically and mentally and spiritually healthy. And to give you a glimpse of how mind impacts the body, let's watch a small clip. Okay, it's called the placebo effect. Placebo in Latin means I shall please. So what this means is, if you take a pill, a dummy pill which does not have any pharmacological content in it, but you believe that it is going to relieve your pain, it actually relieves your pain. And there are many aspects to it, so let's watch that, how mind impacts the body.
Now, you've all heard of the placebo effect before, when something with no known therapeutic value can actually make people feel better. It's a great trick our minds play on us, that by believing and expecting something to work, it actually does. But what's weird is that the strength of the effect can differ for some really strange reasons. For example, the same placebo can treat pain half as well as aspirin, while at the same time treating pain half as well as morphine. Morphine's a much more powerful painkiller, but a placebo is half as effective as both. Saying a placebo will reduce pain reduces pain, but saying that the same placebo will increase pain increases pain. Believing that a placebo will make you feel better will make you feel better. Believing that it won't has the opposite effect. Now, placebos aren't just pills. They can be creams, injections, surgeries, or drinks. You can even get placebo buttons. They don't actually do anything, but they sure as hell make you feel like you're in control. But not all placebos are equal. The effect of the placebo is bigger when the pill itself is bigger. Or if you have two instead of one. Or two once a day instead of one twice a day. And a capsule will usually beat a pill. And a syringe will usually beat a capsule. And anything with a big ass science machine can outperform any of them. A plain pill works worse than a branded one. A discounted pill works worse than a pricey one. And even a pill in a plain box does worse than one that's all shiny and shit. Placebos that are blue work best as downers, and placebos that are red are better as uppers. Studies have shown that people who take their meds on a regular basis are less likely to die than those that don't, even if those meds are all placebos. You can even get addicted to placebos. In one study, a group of women took placebos for more than 5 years. 40% of them suffered withdrawals afterwards. In fact, the effect of placebos can be so strong that some people want them banned from sports. But I mean, how would you even test for that? Placebos don't even seem to work from place to place. For example, in Germany, using a placebo to treat ulcers works better than anywhere else in Europe. But using a placebo that treats hypertension doesn't work nearly as well as it does for its neighbours. Now, remember that all of this is about comparing things that both have nothing medically effective in them, which goes to show that a placebo isn't about what's in it, but about the beliefs that we load onto it. Our minds create the medicine, and that is pretty freaking weird.
Interesting. And this is all backed up by research. It's not just anecdotal. There are quite a few experiments that have been done to show that mind indeed impacts the body, and some of which you have seen here. And this is a very big area of research, of trying to research the placebo effect of what is it, what is the mechanism by which mind impacts the body, and some of which we will explore today. I'm going to show you another example of how expectation or anticipation of recovery influences the actual recovery. There was this doctor, an orthopedic surgeon. He wanted to know whether a sham surgery, that means a placebo surgery, he is not doing surgery, but he makes the patient believe that he is doing the surgery, will it have the same kind of impact as the actual surgery? Question is clear? Now let's see what happens.
The idea was to treat people in great pain. Volunteers with severe knee arthritis were gathered from around the state and divided into groups. Two groups would have a surgical procedure. The third would be given a placebo, fake surgery. They'd have a general anesthetic, be opened up, but wouldn't have any real procedure. They would merely think they had. I had to meet the surgeon.
It's very important for the patients not to know which treatment that they have. And they're always trying to look for clues. You know, they're always trying to get you to tell them. And the best way to avoid that, of course, is to not know as a doctor until the last minute which treatment they're going to have.
Each patient would receive a general anesthetic, but only two groups would have an actual procedure. Not even the surgical staff knew who was in each group until they were in the theater.
I would open the envelope in the room and I would read it, but I wouldn't announce it out loud. And then I would show it to the nurses who were working with me, and I would show it to the anesthesiologist, and nobody would ever say which of the three treatments was revealed in the envelope. We had a very elaborate ruse, if you will. I would play a videotape on the TV of a real surgery. And while I was watching the TV, I would ask for instruments and pass things back and forth and carry on conversation as if it was what I would really have done if what was happening on the TV screen was actually going on during that surgery. So we would have water splashing, we would have instruments clanking, and we would do this for the same amount of time that the actual surgery on the videotape took place, so that a patient and their family couldn't watch the clock and say, oh, we were only in the operating room for 10 minutes, so it must have been a pretend surgery.
All this acting felt a bit weird to a doctor trained in standard surgical procedures.
In the big picture, always in the back of my mind, I was thinking, good gosh, here's a patient who we're pretending to do surgery on, we're not really doing surgery, and you know, I'm a physician and a healer after all, and is this kind of really, you know, the right thing to do? Or what have I gotten myself into?
It took 2 years for the study to be completed. Finally, it was time for Dr. Mosley to hear the truth from the patients themselves.
I would say, if you think that the surgery helped your knee, I want you to give me a thumbs up. If you think the surgery didn't help your knee, I want you to give me a thumbs down. And if you're not sure or you're kind of neutral, just hold your hand flat.
Let me try
The verdict? Success for every group, fake or genuine. Sham surgery had worked. The patients who had it were astonished.
The response ranged from, you've got to be kidding me, I can't believe it, bewilderment, there must be a mistake, because they all felt so strongly that something had happened to change what was going on inside their knee.
During your training, what were you taught about the placebo effect?
Nothing. I had no clue. I went from being a skeptic to a believer. I realized that we were really on to something. There are clearly cases where we do surgeries and it's as much or more the patient's feeling about the surgery that influences the result as the actual surgery itself.
Dr. Mosley had seen patients get better purely because of what was in their minds. The pain had gone. It seemed too good to be true, and it did all happen 7 years ago. I wanted to see one of the patients who'd been in great pain before having Dr. Mosley's surgery. I wanted to know whether the placebo effect could still hold.
When I first had that pain, when I first, before that, I couldn't do a lot of things I did. Like going fishing or playing basketball or going dancing. And after that, I was able to do that.
He could. Woo. We could go dancing. He took me dancing and he could dance all night.
Can you describe what the pain was like before the operation?
Terrible, awful. I didn't think that it could be any worse.
It's emotional. Why is it because you were in so much pain before?
Yes.
And what would you say it was that really cured you? Was it Dr. Mosley, or was it you and your mind?
That is kind of an intriguing question, you know, because I got to credit Dr. Mosley for doing what he did. But it was my mind that cured the problem.
I knew that Dr. Mosley's patients had been cured by the sham operation, but I wasn't expecting it to have changed his life. I mean, he couldn't talk about the pain that he'd experienced without crying.
And those of you interested, is this just once? No. Bruce Mosley went ahead. He did the experiment on 120 people. Exactly same process. And he got same results. And he published his research in British Medical Journal. If anyone of you is interested, drop me an email and I'll send you the published paper. So the same Bruce Mosley went ahead and did that experiment with 120 people. So what does this teach us? What can we take away for us? One of the explanations is placebo effect gets its power from the meaning we ascribe to what the doctor is doing to us or what the pill that we are taking. If you feel that it is meaningless and this medicine won't work, it won't work. But if you strongly feel that this medicine does work, then it does work. So whatever medicines whoever is taking, it helps for you to, instead of just popping a pill, to create a ritual around it. And then say, this is life-giving elixir or medicine that I am having, which has the power to cure me, to heal my body. Make those few thoughts and then consume it. And research shows that this kind of taking the medicine is definitely more beneficial than just popping a pill. Now let's move ahead. That's the process. What you think is felt by the body through the brain. That's the causal pathway. Because thought is something which you cannot see. So what neuroscientists would want is, they want something tangible. If you say that you are happy, what part of your brain is lighting up so that I can measure it? So that I know whether your happiness has increased or decreased in an objective fashion. And we will see some of those, of what they have done in order to measure which areas of the brain and how meditation impacts it and how thoughts impact which parts of the brain and how that impacts the various parts of our body. So we have positive emotions, we have negative emotions, yes? And when you have these positive emotions, brain generates positive neuropeptides, the feel-good chemicals. That's why when you laugh, you know, just at the end of Radhika Ben's session, almost all of you must have been feeling a little lighter. Yes? Because you're feeling good. And the negative emotions create negative neuropeptides. I'm trying to simplify it, really, really simplify, just for us to understand the gist. So please don't go by the every single thing that I'm going to show here. Just try to grab the essence of it. So endorphins and enkephalins, they are the pain-killing chemicals. Steroids and adrenaline, the stress chemicals. These are the ones that release healing energy where you feel good, release the harmful energy where you feel stressed and weak, and that's what promotes health, and that's what promotes disease. So now there is a causal link between persistent negative thinking and disease. And there is a causal link between constant and long-term positive emotional experience and improvement in the quality of life and health. Now let's explore some of those. In 2000, the American Physical Association elected Martin Seligman, the psychologist, as the head of American Psychological Association, APA. Until then, for nearly more than 200 years, as long as the psychology existed, it was always interested in exploring the disease of the mind, what all diseases we get. But Martin Seligman said in 2000 that we should change. It's not that every single person is unhappy in the world. In spite of all the difficulties, we are reasonably happy, yes or no? So what is it that makes us thrive? We should research in that area. And thus, positive psychology was born. And today, there are tens of laboratories, hundreds of scientists who are researching on the benefits of positive emotions. And I'm going to share with you some of those. How does it help to be compassionate? We always ask, if I have to think positive, or anything that you're asked to do, the first question is, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? Good question. So today I'm going to share with you, what's in it for you if you start thinking positive and start feeling those positive emotions? Research shows that when you are compassionate, that compassion improves the strength of vagal tone. Vagal nerve starts from the back of your brain here, and then it innervates all your visceral organs, including heart, stomach. And the strength of the vagal tone governs what kind of cardiovascular issues that you are going to face in your life. So with compassion, it has been found that it strengthens the vagal tone. And there's a big laboratory that researches in the field of compassion and altruism. So that's here, Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford. For those of you interested, you can copy this URL. It's called ccare.stanford.edu, where a lot of material and work you will find about applications of compassion and how to learn to be compassionate with the self and with the others. Why should I do charity? It's going to benefit the other person. Is it going to benefit me? And in Hindi, we say neki kar. It so beautifully captures. You know why? You can fake anybody in the world, including your spouse, but you can't fake your brain. So when you genuinely do an act of charity, somehow body seems to respond and your immune system seems to improve. Those people who do at least one act of charity per week have been found to be more healthier, to be more resistant to the seasonal infections than those who do not do any act of charity. And you're interested in learning more, that's the place. Greater Good Science Center at University of California, Berkeley. A bunch of scientists who are working in this area exploring how for those people who think of greater good, who have this give mindset, who share, what impact does it have on different aspects of their life? How many of you thank yourself, thank your family, thank everyone in general at least once a week? You can start doing it from today, those of who are not doing it, those of you are doing, fantastic. Because research again shows those who are grateful that I have all these things. And if you can write three things that you are grateful for every day, just three things, it's been shown that you are going to be more happy and more healthy. Shall we do the exercise now? Yes? Go ahead, pull your books, pen, just reflect and write three things that you are grateful for. Three things that you are thankful for in your life at this point of time. Go ahead, write it. You can be grateful for your people at home, your workplace, whatever. How many of you have written four things that you're grateful for? Good. Usually when I write my gratitude journal, I start with saying, good that I'm still alive. I start there and I thank the body for helping me go through the whole day and supporting whatever I wanted to do. So that gratefulness starts from the self. Okay? And please remember, this is one of the key takeaways. Is it difficult? Was it so difficult to recall what we are grateful for, what you should be grateful for? Do this exercise every day. Just write three things that you are grateful for that day in the night. And it has been shown that that improves your sleep, that improves your health, and that improves your happiness. And you're interested in learning more, that's the place. Wellbeing Laboratory at University of California, Riverside. Sonia Lyubimirsky is the scientist who has been doing pioneering research for the last decade and a half in this area. Good. Any questions so far? Okay? Good. Those are the other positive emotions where a lot of work is being done. Kristin Neff is doing pioneering research in the field of self-compassion, being compassionate towards the self. Because usually we are very, very critical of the self. We kick ourselves black and blue. When a friend of yours fails in the exam and then he or she comes to you, what do you tell them? Padhai nahi karenge to aisa hi hoga. Acha hai, bhugto. You say that? What do you say? Now, when you fail, what do you tell yourself? Am I not eligible for my own love? And I need love when I least deserve it. I need love when I least deserve it. Same with the other people. And who knows me the best? Who knows me the best? Who is best positioned to love me? That's another aspect of meditation. You will learn a lot more about that in tomorrow's session when Suraj Bhai is going to talk to us about Svaman, giving respect to the self and exploring what is positive, what is beautiful that you have been hearing since morning. It takes time to sit there and then look at yourself from a different perspective. And that's one of the fundamental things that you learn here as a part of Raj Yoga from Brahma Kumaris. Forgiveness. There's a forgiveness center at Stanford, and it shows when you forgive, your stress levels go down. What does forgiving mean? What does letting go mean? You hurt me, and when I see you, that still comes, that thought still comes. So what does it mean to forgive you? Now this is very important. Forgiveness does not mean I am going to forget. Forgiveness does not mean I have to go to that fellow and hug and kiss him. No. Forgiveness means this insight that, yes, you hurt me in the past, but I will not allow the hurt from the past to interfere with my present. That insight is forgiveness. And that's what liberates you from that pain from the past becoming your suffering in the present. That's forgiveness. Loving kindness, we will also practice that as a part of 7 to 7:30 meditation, where when you spread those vibrations of that kindness, of that karuna, of that love, that helps you. And we are going to explore how a few minutes of loving kindness meditation practiced over a few years practically changes the structure of the brain. I'm going to show you that. So the many scientists, more than 200, as I said, hundreds of them, tens of universities working on these positive emotions. So for those of you who ask this question, what is positive thinking? What is positive emotion? All BS. No, it's not. There is a lot of science behind it, and these are very, very powerful and potent weapons in our arsenal, and they cost. So some of the benefits: improved health, improved sense of well-being, longevity, greater quality of life, which is what all of us desire. And the easiest way is to make and feel those positive emotions for a few minutes every day. Difficult? Be honest. Difficult? So you want to start that process? So that process of experiencing those positive emotions is what another definition of meditation. Now, how does meditation impact different parts of brain? When scientists talk about impact, they usually talk about what we call as neural pathways. When you make a thought, when you are having an experience, which parts of the brain are being impacted in what sequence? That's what they call it as a neural pathway. So there are four primary neural pathways that are impacted by meditation. First one is better emotional control during stressful situations. How does that happen? Let me show you which parts of the brain get impacted for us to get this benefit from the meditation. What do these negative emotions do? There is a word for that. It's called as amygdala hijack or emotional hijack. When you are upset, okay, the emotional center of the brain, which is called as amygdala, when it flares up, your ability to think clearly is lost. This part of the brain is the limbic system or the emotional center of the brain. And this part of the brain, that is this part, is what we call as a PFC, prefrontal cortex, that helps us in logical thinking, in experiencing, in planning. In general, it is this part that makes us human. Now, do you see these connections, these four lines, dark lines? Okay? These are the connections from the emotional brain to your thinking brain. And the reverse connections are, you see the dotted line? Which one is higher? This one. That's why, how does this translate? How much time does it take to get angry? Be honest. How much time does it take to calm down from the anger? For some of us, for certain things, sometimes never. Unfortunate. But meditation has been shown to increase those connections from your thinking brain to your emotional brain. Through practice, when you keep practicing that, brain starts growing more connections so that in spite of that stimulus, you won't become emotional. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. What's the difference? When you add your emotional reactivity to the existing pain, that is what becomes suffering. And meditation has been shown to reduce this emotional reactivity by increasing the control of the thinking brain over the emotional brain. That's the first benefit. That's the first neural pathway. Any questions? Okay, next. It boosts attention circuits. When you start meditating, when you start focusing, initially your mind goes everywhere under the sun, sometimes beyond the sun also. And that's okay, that's absolutely fine. The process is to bring your mind back to what you're focusing. It goes somewhere, you bring it back. It goes again, you bring it again. This goes on. But the time between the mind wandering starts decreasing with practice. And that is what boosts your attention. So don't give up. If your mind is wandering, you're falling asleep in meditation, there's nothing wrong. That's exactly what happens in the beginning. Don't give up. Keep doing it. Because what has been found is just with 8 weeks of meditation, doing only for 10 minutes a day, has been shown to decrease the activity in prefrontal cortex, where a lot of thoughts get generated. And the activity in this part of the brain deep inside, it's called thalamus. That is the gatekeeper of our senses. There's a lot of information that is going to the brain through the senses, but the brain doesn't process everything. Unless it is processed by the PFC, you don't experience it. Let me give an example. Pay attention to the hissing sound of the AC. Able to hear? It was there all through for the last 2.5 hours. When you paid attention, that signal became more prominent in your prefrontal cortex. Cortex started processing it. That's what became your experience. So when the activity in thalamus goes down, what it means is, in spite of the disturbances being around, I am not disturbed because I learned to not to process those extra noise. Less noise means more signal. More signal means more focus. So by turning down the activity inside thalamus and in the cortex, meditation helps improve attention. Another interesting thing that you would see in many of the people whom you meet here. How does that lightness come about when you meditate? You agree with that? All the schools of philosophy and spirituality and practices all over the world, if there is one goal, it is how to tame the wandering mind. Because a wandering mind is the cause of all the unhappiness and sorrow. And what has been found is when mind wanders, most of the time, what happened in the past to me, what will happen in the future, this has a particular set of neurons inside the brain which scientists call as default mode network. Okay, or the narrative network. It keeps generating all sorts of stories. If you give it a few minutes and if you're not focusing, you are already under the influence of DMN. And interesting part is, DMN makes us as the center of the universe, as if you are the only one under the sun and nobody else is there. And that I-ness, those thoughts belonging to me, become sticky. And most of the sorrow is coming because of that stickiness. And meditation teaches you to go beyond. And it shows very clearly this DMN, the default mode network, starts calming down. Fascinating stuff. So you sit and meditate, you practice the swaman, you practice the meditation, you start practicing the positive qualities inside yourself. There is a certain portion of your brain where the activity which talks about the self is calming down. And reduced activity in DMN means less mind wandering. Less mind wandering means less worry. Less worry means less unhappiness. It's another very interesting stuff. Where does this lightness come from? The unhappiness or that heaviness comes from the stickiness of our thoughts when we are attached to certain things, to people, to elements. But through meditation, it has been found that there is one particular area of the brain called nuclear accumbens, which actually reduces in size by, when the size reduces marginally, it means there is less attachment. And meditation practice lightens our sense of self. And it does it by reducing the stickiness of thoughts. And that gives us the sense of freedom. And that is what you experience as you meditate. You feel light. And that comes out in your behavior, in your attitude, in your lifestyle in general. So many silly things that we are so concerned about. Once you start practicing meditation, that stickiness is lost. You're no longer so attached to things. Attachment is not moving away, as Shivani Ben was beautifully explaining. It's not indifference. It is not allowing the external stimuli to control me. And that's the result that you would get through constant meditation. Let's go to the last one. Strengthening the circuits of compassion and empathy. Brain circuit for happiness is energized, and loving kindness also boosts connections between brain circuits for joy and happiness and prefrontal cortex. That means as you keep practicing meditation, you can experience joy and happiness on demand. And that's something beautifully you see in Dadi Janki or some of the senior yogis whom you'll meet here, and one of them you'll meet tomorrow in the form of Suraj Pai. On demand, you can experience happiness and joy and power, and he's going to show you how by just changing a few thoughts. And that's what the science is also talking about. The connections between the brain circuits for joy and happiness and prefrontal cortex increase. That means you start becoming more in control of your own feelings. You must be thinking that this is too good to be true. It is too good to be true. Because it is too good and true. And a lot of this material is coming out because of the last 40 years of research, and it comes from this book called Science of Meditation by Daniel Goleman. If you're interested in reading about the whole lot of research that's being done in the last 40, 45 years and a good summary of it, that's the book. Science of Meditation by Daniel Goleman and Richard Davidson. Now, in Patanjali Yoga Sutras, we talk about three different forms of dukkha, the sorrow, and our goal is to be happy. Yes or no? So, how do we experience sorrow in three forms? One is Adi Daivika Dukkha, the second one is Adi Bhautika, and the third one is Adhyatmika. Adi Daivika means, Adi means related to. Daivika means which is beyond my control, based on my fate, whatever happens. Adi Bhautika means that which comes from other people and through this body. And Adhyatmika, that's where the word comes. Atmika means related to the soul, related to the self. Adi means related to. Adhyatmika means related to the soul or the self. The third one generates the most amount of sorrow. And where does that come from? Any situation has two constituents. One is there are facts in the situation, and then there is a story I tell myself about the facts. Very interesting. My boss yelled at me. That's the fact. Now, next comes the story. My kid failed in the exam. That's the fact. Next comes the story. I lost my ring. That's the fact. Next comes the story. And more than 90% of our dukkha, sorrow, this is not such a big thing. This is. And that's both empowering and scary. Empowering because I can change the story. Scary because now I can no longer blame anybody else. Because I can take the control of my life, as you've seen. And two spiritual practices which are very, very important, which help us overcome this adhyatmika dukkha or the self-generated sorrow. You know, usually I say that each one of us has become experts in generating sorrow. Even from a normal situation, we extract sorrow and then feel bad about it. We become experts at it. There's nothing to be worried about, but we generate something. And that's where a lot of unhappiness and sorrow comes from. But two practices help. Can you guess what those two are? And they're very, very powerful. And that's what even Sister Shivani was talking about and Sister Radhika was talking about. Two practices. Sorry? Yeah. No, no. What are the two practices? Yes, it's all related to thoughts. Self-appreciation. Positive affirmations. Being conscious. Forgiveness. Balance. Acceptance. Very good. Awareness. Okay. So the first one, not just awareness, non-judgmental awareness. And the second most important practice is detachment. Now let me show you, let me demonstrate what Sister Shivani was speaking about so that it's very easy for us to remember what detachment is. Can you pull up your books on which you are writing, start reading. Whatever you have written, start reading. All of you can do this exercise, whoever is carrying the book. You can read that? You're able to read? Now slowly bring that book closer to you. You can still read it? Bring it even closer. You can still read it? Fantastic. Bring it even closer. Close your face with that book. Hold there. If I force you to read, what will you do? You can't read, yeah? You can't read. Why?
Too much important that book.
What is it that is getting sacrificed, which is not allowing you to read when you bring that book so close? The distance, the lack of distance sacrifices the clarity. Clarity comes from distance. It is still your book. It is still your baby. It is still your problem. As in management, famous HBR article, it is still your monkey. But if you want to handle it, if you want to see the facts and not get carried away with the story, create that distance between yourself and your situation. That's when clarity improves. That's when you can start seeing the facts and not get carried away with your story. And then solving that situation becomes a lot more easier. Creating that distance between yourself and the situation, it is still your situation, is detachment. And when you bring the situation so close and you're so upset, getting really worked up, that is attachment. And you saw, when you get emotional, when emotional centers are flared up, our logical thinking goes out of the window. That's why this is so, so, so important. Easy? No, I should ask a better question. Simple? Yeah. For the last 1 hour, I've never used this word easy. None of this is easy. And I'm the first one to admit, it takes practice. But it is simple. There's nothing complicated about it. You don't have to solve quantum mechanics equations to understand. It's very simple. But with practice, definitely the result is far higher. And what is non-judgmental awareness? The beautiful word in Sanskrit, it's called Sakshi Drashta Sthiti. Drashta means to see. Sakshi means witness. See the facts in the situation without getting influenced. And these two things go together. This is another equation. There are thoughts and there are feelings. When does a thought become a feeling? When you add judgment to it. From office to home, every day you pass through. And if I ask you to recall, what are those things that you will recall? That which pulled your attention, that which made you emotional, that which you judged, whether good or bad, that's what gets registered. Because our brains are primed for that. So when you remove this judgment, a thought remains a thought. You are able to see the fact. And when that energy of emotion is removed, what happens? What happens? It becomes easy for me to handle the situation. And that's why this is given so much importance of becoming non-judgmentally aware. Sakshi Drashta Sthiti. And it's fantastic. In Raja Yoga, we learn, किसी भी परिस्थिति में निर्णय शक्ति को बढ़ाना है तो साक्षी दृष्टा की स्थिति में स्थित रहो. That's what we learn in Rajyoga. In any situation, if you want to improve your decision making capability, practice non-judgmental awareness. Then it becomes easy for me to make the decision because the facts are no longer colored with my emotion. And this is what I was talking about. It takes reflection, it takes time. But the benefits are really huge. And how to change our beliefs? Let me show you a simple clip. Interesting, yeah? Balls are moving up. Yes? That's what is visible. Now watch. where the ball's actually moving up. What changed? What changed? My perspective has changed. In the beginning, what was I perceiving? Balls moving up. Even though I know that cannot be done, but that is what I'm seeing, that's what I'm perceiving. Irrespective of reality, my perception is my reality. Yet another point for each one of you to sit and reflect. Who you are, I don't care. Because I've already decided who you have to be. Because my perception is my reality. And if I want to change my perception, I should change my... And the beauty is, I'm not touching the reality. Have you seen that? And what Radhika Ben was explaining, wo abhi theek se khata nahi hai, lekin wo mere liye problem nahi hai abhi. He didn't change, the reality didn't change. He is throwing the same amount of food outside the plate. But I'm absolutely fine. Because my perception, my perspective has changed. And this is exactly what Brahmakumaris provide. An alternate set of perspectives to look at yourself and to look at the world so that the way you are interpreting the world, the way you are interpreting your experiences, the story you are telling yourself about the same facts, that is what Brahmakumaris help change. That is what Raja Yoga helps change. And it all begins with this first lesson all of you heard in the morning. Very simple. I am not this body, I am a soul. I am not a bundle of weaknesses, I am a bag of virtues. You see that? It's a simple way, a different way of looking at things. Change in perspective. When my perspective changes, my perception changes. When my perception changes, my reality changes. When my reality changes, my experience and my reaction to that reality changes. And that's what starts becoming more and more empowering. In the process, did I change my spouse? Did I change my boss? Did I change my kid? Did I change the evening traffic in all the metros, whether it is Pune, Bombay, Delhi, or Hyderabad? What did I change? Who has the control on my perspective? That's the most beautiful thing I liked here at Brahmakumaris when I learned Raja Yoga meditation 26 years ago. It gives you back the power to lead your own life and be control of your own emotions. You are no longer a puppet. If you want to, that's the key thing. If you want to, you can take that control back. And that's what you saw, how meditation, in giving back that control, practically changes the physical structure of the brain. So now, if there are any skeptics among you who think that, hey, meditation kya hai, apne liye nahi hai, 60 saal ke baad. I keep asking this question. If you were a student, when will you need your textbooks and guides? After your retirement? After you failed all the exams? Or while you are writing the exam? When you are in that age of writing exams, that's exactly what meditation is for. Good, so that brings us to the end, unless you have any questions. And these are some of the books that you can refer. It's talking about Science of Meditation by Daniel Goleman, Biology of Hope by Norman Cousins, Love, Medicine, and Miracles by Bernie S. Siegel, Placebo Response by Richard Craddon, and there's a book that's got released by Nautic Institute, which talks about consciousness and healing. There are many, but these will give you a small sample to learn about how thoughts and mind impact the body. Okay, yes.
Like happy living, good diet, or exercising. So, like, as you said that you wanted to be doing after the retirement or at the young age.
Sorry, I didn't get the question. Can you repeat?
I'm saying that whatever setup you have described, to understand that, the deepness of this goes that you should do the meditation. I'm saying, is there any other setup of things which to be added up or Absolutely. Can be delinked or do only that, it will be equal giving the same results?
We have explored the impact of meditation because that's how research and science approaches. If I take one particular activity, what is its impact? I need to understand. It does not mean only meditation is sufficient. Good diet, good exercise and meditation and good sleep, very, very important. And of course, through these, naturally the relationships will also improve. So all of them complement each other. But the primary amongst those is meditation, because that is what will help you become more compassionate towards yourself, which will motivate you to eat better, sleep well, and move more.
Again, I saw the four things which I said that you did on that, and exercise and health. Well, to give a live example of my own, yes, these are the four things which I am doing, not today, it's from the ages I am doing it, and I am now touching 60. Unfortunately, I couldn't settle down on a meditation. I tried number of times, but as you said, that people get out of that. Though I did the Raj Yoga 7 days course also. So rest of the four things, it is still on.
Good.
I more or less call myself, yes, it's a balanced life. But still, some part is missing. That's why I'm here.
Welcome.
And I keep on
we'll
coming here.
You.
Now, I'm repeating my question in another shape. Like, if I miss that meditation, since I am not able to do it,
yeah.
Again, it's a, like you can say the thought or your thought process that you are not able to do it, negative thought.
Whatever the reason, yeah.
How to boost that if I have to go on the same path?
Absolutely.
Or is there some other way out? It's not a shortcut I'm asking for, but clubbing it, because four of the rest of the things, it's still there. And I'm very convinced, very positive, and I'm doing it.
Fantastic. It's very important to also understand the definition of meditation. What, according to you, is meditation, and what makes you think that you are not able to do meditation is something that needs to be explored. That we will do it break ke baad.
Om Shanti.
Yes.
The point is that, okay, we know about something divinity or we love God or something like that, okay. But let the person who really, he's a Nastic, let's say. So, us time pe, wo bande ko meditation or ye wala relation kaise kaam mein aayega? I don't, because
Did I use the word God in
no, no,
the
no,
last
no.
one and a half?
No, I'm coming to that. Let's say, what I'm giving, because not judgmental awareness and detachment. Okay, in that scenario, I am unable to, let's say, because whenever we're talking with the people like that way, let's say for example giving, at that time non-judgmental awareness and detachment, we can't give in practical way. Means how we can express the people non-judgmental awareness. Let's say I am not examiner, I am the observer. Okay, that is the one thing, okay. But in Raja Yoga meditation, if we are talking about we are the son of the Supreme or like that way, in that situation, how we can understood, means how we can correlate that the thing, yeah.
getting connected with the Supreme is one element of Raj Yoga meditation. First, you are encouraged to experience yourself as separate from this body. And if you read The Science of Meditation that Daniel Goleman has written and review the research, that's a fascinating practice. Because that is helping you to unstuck that attachment that you have developed and the wrong thought processes that have gone into, the wrong lens we are using to process the stimuli. The first step is that soul consciousness. Remembering God comes later. A lot of benefits can be achieved only through soul consciousness. Lot of benefits. So what you just asked about non-judgmental awareness and detachment can be got through practice of soul consciousness. And the research that I reviewed is, to use the word, election season, is completely secular. Because the complete research has been done on mindfulness, which doesn't talk a word about God. So it's possible. Long answer short, even for a Gnostic, even an atheist can take the benefit of meditation. Yeah, absolutely. They don't have to believe in God. Yes, last question.
How to reduce forgotness?
How to?
How to reduce forgotness?
Forgetfulness.
Forgetfulness.
How do you reduce?
Yeah.
You have a book, sir, with you?
No.
That's the first step. Carry the book. That's what I started off saying. Do not trust your brain. We are not so good. Be humble. You have a mobile? Set up reminders. You have a voicemail? Give yourself voicemail. That's what I used to do. I would call my extension in office. If there is a bunch of things that I need to do, I would leave voice message to myself. So go to the office, listen to the voice message, make notes, and then start doing things. Very simple. So forgetfulness is not, when you try to remember too many things, you can't. So the simplest way is to use a book, make a note, and use that book. Now, if I forget to see the book also, as I said, we'll discuss that break kebab. But for now, most of the forgetfulness should be resolved by using a simple book and making a note of it. Yes.
So I will not take much of your time, and I would like to thank you and Sister Shivani and the Sister Radhika for all the wonderful sessions. Where you talked about the positive emotions and health, you talked about self-compassion, forgiveness, and loving-kindness. I wanted to know more about forgiveness when it comes to the self-forgiveness.
Yes.
Yeah, so I wanted your inputs on the same.
As I said, both self-forgiveness and self-compassion are very, very closely related. It takes time. It takes practice. If you know that whatever has happened, you don't have to blame yourself, it has just happened, and it's reality, it's happened. Yes, we are not trying to run away from it. But this reflection, by detaching yourself from it and then looking at this scenario, developing that practice helps reduce that emotional reactivity. It takes time. With practice, one of the best practices that I have learned in Raj Yoga, and this again comes from bite-sized principles that we learn. Bache, jab man bahut chanchal ho, to usko ashariri pan ka injection de do. When your mind is too disturbed, you just give it an injection of bodilessness. Visualize yourself as being a point of light, eternal point of light. I had many births before, I will have many births hereafter. Whatever has happened for me in this life is temporary. It's not going to go with me as a soul. That practice, again, it's not easy. That practice will actually help you to start generating enough self-compassion so that you can start forgiving yourself. Because that is how spirituality ties with helping us become psychologically stronger. Okay? So just stand up once. Very good. Please stand up. Say what I say and do what I do. Front. Up. Front. Up. Front. Down. Say what I say, but don't do what I do. Say what I say, but don't do what I do. Up. Front. Down. Front. Up. Down. What was the instruction? Very good. Thank you very much. Sit down.